This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
Hello, everybody. We welcome you to the Money Talk program. Brand new week on the air, brand new Monday. A lot of stuff going on in the world of the markets, a lot of speculation, and a lot of hashing out of what happened last week. The big news from last week, of course, is the Federal Reserve having its two-day meeting, and as expected, raising the Fed fund rate, which is the rate that the Federal Reserve charges member banks for money, raising it by a quarter of a point, which is what we expected, and bringing the Fed fund rate up to 0.75. Stocks closed little changed today. Matter of fact, the Dow Jones, I looked at it at 4 o'clock, and literally at 4 o'clock, it was still in positive territory. But what happens is when the market closes, whatever trades are sort of in the hopper, they have to be cleared, they have to be completed. No new trades are being accepted, but the ones that are already in the queue, so to speak, have to be cleared. And if the dominant number of trades are issued by sells versus the dominant number being issued by buys, in other words, if selling orders outpace buy orders, then you're going to find that once the market gives you its final cleared numbers, which is several minutes after 4 p.m., then you get, you know, the end result. And that's what happened today. Literally at 4 o'clock, the market was in the black. And finished negative as a result. Not dramatically, so some people would arguably say it was basically flat. The NASDAQ composite hit an all-time high in mid-morning trading before ending just basically slightly higher. Some of what drove was the tech stocks like Apple, which reached a record high of its own. We're still the market itself a little bit expensive, and that's going to keep the market from moving dramatically higher from here, according to analysts like Jeremy Klein, who's with FBN Securities. He also said that investors were positioning themselves for the upcoming earnings season. I mean, let's face it, this is March. We're getting close to the end of it. So in April, you're going to start getting earnings numbers for the first quarter of 2017. They start with an alphabetical order with, you know, a number of different companies, Alcoa Aluminum being among them, being the symbol as it starts with two A's, AA, and running right through for the next several weeks. And my guess is, absent a lot of other major news that might be part of the mix, and the fact the Federal Reserve won't be a major part of the discussion for at least several weeks again until their next meeting comes up later in the year. At this stage of the game, they'll be debating what they think the Fed will do next. But most importantly, they'll be looking at the earnings numbers to see just how fast is this economy growing, how fast are earnings growing within the companies that make up the publicly traded economy, and what does that portend for the future? And maybe what do they think the Fed will be doing in the future? We've talked about it many times. I think we've gotten a lot of affirmation from the so-called experts, I guess the prognosticators, the economists, that they think the Fed is prepared to raise interest rates three times this year. So they've done it once already. That would give them two more times. That would get the Fed fund rate up to from a, where it started the year, which was 0.50 or 0.5%, up to 1.25%. That would be the roughly three moves we would get this year, three-quarter point moves. That is still historically low. That is still historically accommodative. It still represents cheap money policy. But, you know, the markets are funky about that. And let's face it, the stock market does like low, low cost of money and low, low interest rates as a result. Now, the Dow did slip by the time markets cleared today. It was down 8 points, a small number, but it was down. Home Depot and Goldman Sachs, probably of the 30 companies that make up the Dow, contributed the most to that decline. A lot of people are just on hold, according to Bob Pavlik, and they're sort of waiting to go in either direction. They're not quite sure. They're afraid to make a move, afraid to be out of the market if the market moves higher. They're afraid to be overly exposed to the market if the market suddenly decides to correct. The market is just waiting for some new catalyst to move us one way or the other. There hasn't been one, really, no major catalyst in the past few weeks. And I say that even though the Fed did make their move last week, but they've been telegraphing it and expecting it for a very long, long time. So I don't think the market was shocked at all. The S&P was down 0.2% today. Utilities leading decliners. Investors want to know what the Fed has to say about the next rate hike. So according to Adam Sarhan, who's with 50 Park Investments, that's going to be the headline going forward. So they're going to be listening to all of the talking heads from the Fed, people who are presidents of various Federal Reserve banks around the country, individuals who make up the open market committee that votes on what Federal Reserve policy is going to be. The U.S. Central Bank raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months, last week only. But as I said, the dot plot that shows each member's expectations for where rates will be in coming years changed little from the last meeting. So there was not a lot of philosophical change on the Open Market Committee, which is members of the Fed board that actually get to vote on some of these changes in policy. Chicago Fed President, for example, Charles Evans, said that the central bank will wait until June to actually decide on the next rate hike. And the Fed tries to remind everyone that they're not on some sort of a policy track, but instead that they're data-driven, they're data-dependent. They're looking to see how do moves by the Federal Reserve tightening a little bit, how do they affect markets, how do they affect the overall economy. They know they're in a political year. This is a brand new year with a brand new executive in the White House, the executive branch, pretty much made up of all new players across the board. And of course, the House and the Senate are, for the most part, in the control of the Republicans. So what kind of fiscal policy, which is what comes out of Washington, D.C., what kind of fiscal policy can move forward, which could involve spending for infrastructure, could involve tax cuts or major changes in tax policy in Washington, how that will affect corporations as well as individuals. A lot of things along these lines. And, of course, the big play, the big elephant in the room, which is the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace, which gets a lot of press. But there have not been a great many people talking about their expectations of what's going to happen in Congress. There aren't too many people that are overly confident that some sort of a reasonable bill can be created to replace a potentially repealed Affordable Care Act. And what will the impact be on voters? There are a great many people that may be negatively or adversely impacted by the repeal of the Obamacare Affordable Care Act. And now that they're starting to look it through carefully, look at what the Congressional Budget Office has to say, look at what all the expert analysts outside of the political environment have to say, suddenly discovering Donald Trump may realize, as he's being told now, of course, and of course a great many senators and congressmen are being told, that some of the people who will be most negatively impacted by this, hurt the most, in other words, are their own constituents. Yeah, the people that voted in the Republicans for control of the Senate and the House, the people who voted in the President of the United States. The question will be is, will they make the politically astute decision to walk back their respective programs or to be more aggressive, which is what some of the ultra-conservative groups want to see? It's some guys are walking a very fine line and they're being asked to jump through flaming hoops. What decisions they make will be, well, that's what we are waiting to see in terms of policy. Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari, he spoke on the Squawk Box at CNBC on Monday, saying that he voted against a rate hike last week because he wanted to see more inflation in the United States. If the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it slows down potentially the economy, and that's what these inflation hawks want to see, a little more inflation in the system, and I kind of understand why Kashkari feels that way. Listen, folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa. Glad to have you here on a Monday. This is AM 790, your home of talking business, and we will be right back, so please stick around. And we're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Sowa. Delighted to have you sharing your drive time home with me. If you are in a safe place where you're comfortable to call in, give us a call here at the Money Talk program. The local number is 437-5000, and the toll-free number for you outside the immediate area is 888-345-0790. If it's not safe for you to chat, just give Brett your question. He'll plug it into my screen. He'll make sure that I answer it before you reach your destination. If you are in a comfortable place where you're not going to get the wrong kind of attention from automobiles sneaking up on you, in other words, you're not driving necessarily, call us at 888-345-0790. Brett will let me know that you're waiting online, and I'll get right to you. Answering questions that help you become better informed, If you're working with a financial advisor, which I hope you may be doing, and we'll talk about that in future shows. Tomorrow we actually have a little discussion with Donna Allard. She handles the Get Back to Basics program here on AM 790. And we're going to be talking about that whole issue of the world of advisory. How is it changing? How will it change? And how can that potentially affect you? And how can you benefit from it? What kind of questions do you need to be asking? But again, you can ask questions like that right here on this program. And I do try to anticipate some of the questions you may be asking. Sometimes we get questions on our company's website, and we get calls here at the station. Even when the show is not on, producers let us know what you folks are interested in. I mentioned in the first segment of the show that some of the Fed presidents of the Federal Reserve, people who vote on the direction of Federal Reserve policy, monetary policy, Fed President Neel Kashkari, who's with Minneapolis's Fed program, he said, in Squawk Box, as a matter of fact, said that he voted against the hike this last week because he wanted they would have hiked if they thought the economy might starting to get heated up, and they're trying to balance it out. They'd like to keep it very balanced, but I think that we really need the economy. We'd like to see the economy growing a little faster, maybe a little warmer. That it is right now. I'm sure the president would like to see that. And there are members of the Fed who are considered inflation hawks or Federal Reserve hawks who are also saying that. Now, Philadelphia's Fed president, Patrick Harker, said that it's okay if inflation overshoots the Fed's inflation target. In other words, the Fed sets a target for what the inflation level could comfortably be. The problem with setting targets is that, well, let's face it, this is the 21st century, and what is good, what was great back in the 20th century may not be appropriate. It's a new normal, shall we speak, may not be appropriate here in the 21st century. But they said it's okay if the inflation overshoots the Fed target a little bit as the labor market tends to tighten up a bit. Obviously, there's going to be a lag to inflation. It doesn't happen immediately. Whatever the Fed does, it's months before you actually see it in the economy. We've got to be careful of not getting behind the curve. That's the great worry. Oftentimes, policies that happen in the first quarter of any given year, when the Federal Reserve puts in a new monetary policy, the effect that you were looking for, slowing or tightening or increasing, creating inflation, it could take as much as 6 months before you actually find it. So it could be really in the September-October timeframe before you see the impact of Fed policy. So they've got to be thoughtful. They don't want to be, as I said, behind the curve. Treasuries traded mixed today. The financial services sector with short-term two-year notes slipping to 1.3%, and the 10-year benchmark note yields right around 2.47%. Now, the post-election rise in stocks or equities, as well as Treasury yields, has largely slowed down recently as investors await. They're waiting for some details on the White House's actual tax reform program, on the deregulation in the financial services sector, and government spending proposals. Now, the market has had a pretty big run since the election in November, but especially this year in 2017. And perhaps a little bit of a consolidation is possible here. According to Bruce Biddles, who's with a company called Baird, will likely move sideways here in the near term, and after that, will continue to go up again, possibly. So he's saying we may not have a major correction in the time frame, but you may not see a major continuous climb. The market could move sideways a bit, bouncing up and down a little bit here and there, and then move higher later. Investors also kept an eye on oil prices as prices were pressured by some rising inventories out there. We'll go to the phones. As I mentioned earlier, 437-5000 is our local number, and 888-345-0790. We got Frank out in Coventry. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Quick question here. I have a CD, and once a year I can up the interest rate on it. Okay? And the bank just went up 0.35.
They're going to allow you to increase it by 0.35?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's good for 1 year.
All right.
And again, in 12 months, I can put it up again if I chose.
Now, what are you getting right now on it, Frank?
I don't have it in front of me. It's roughly 1.5.
So it may go up to about 1.85 to just under 1.9?
That's correct.
All right. Let me explain something really quick. As the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, or even as the market does, the banks and financial services companies don't generally pass on that gain for an extended period of time. There's lots of reasons for it. My guess would be that if they're offering, if their rate's going up by about a third of a percent right now at your at your institution, and they're going to still allow you to do it again within 12 months later, I would take it.
You would?
Oh, absolutely, I would. Because I don't think that the Federal Reserve is going to. But put it this way: by the time they're done raising, the Federal Reserve's the rate will be somewhere right in the range of 1.25%. In the 10-year Treasury, which is the most important of the instruments that the government handles right now, is sitting right in around 2.47. I don't think you're going to see that go up dramatically higher. Maybe up to 2.85. But if you're able to get very close to 2% on your instrument, then that's going to be pretty good, especially since they're going to allow you to do it again. I know it's the simplest thing to do, and you know the beauty of it, Frank, is they don't charge you anything for it.
I just can't get over how low the rates are, though. You know what I mean?
Well,
it makes me sick.
You know what you can do, though? We watch these rates carefully, and I even go on bankrate.com. It's online, and they will tell you, they'll list you the top CD rates at banking institutions that are FDIC or NCUA insured all over the country. So you can actually roll over your rates electronically. Even many of these institutions don't have what I call bricks and mortar banks. They're electronic banks, but they're federally insured. And I don't know why this is the case, but for the last 7-8 years, Arkansas-based institutions, the companies that are registered there, offer the highest rates on CDs. And I think it's because of their banking laws. I think the banking laws are a little bit less restrictive there, and that's probably what causes it. So you could even check them out before you lock into the rollover that your bank's given you. But my guess is, from what I've been hearing lately, if you could get 1.85, say, for the next 6 to 7 months, that's not a bad deal. And then, hey, no, a couple of months later, you may see another boost and get up to about 2.25. And at least you're going in the right direction, right?
Thank you very much. I appreciate your advice.
Thanks, Frank. Take care. The market has had a pretty big run, as I mentioned, and I mentioned it wouldn't be surprising if you saw some consolidation. Now, what happens here is that, remember, there's the S&P 500 alone has at least 10 different sectors. There's, you know, utilities, there's financial services, there's energy. You know, you go down the list. The healthcare sector is part of that. And they don't all perform exactly the same. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that during tonight's program. But we see the blue chip large companies, dividend paying stocks doing very nicely. We're in an environment right now where technology companies seem to be doing pretty well. Like, for example, I noted today that of the three primary sectors, the S&P, the Dow, and the NASDAQ, which is heavily weighted technology, is the one that actually was up today. I think overall has been doing the best in what we call the Trump bump going forward. But you've got to be very thoughtful and careful about it. We may start seeing part of consolidation doesn't just mean potential value corrections like the blue chips coming down all of a sudden. Because keep something in mind, the P.E. ratio of the market's around 20 right now. That's the pricing multiple. Now, P.E. means price divided by earnings. It's the price of the stock share divided by its earnings per share. And the number itself may not be meaningful to everybody, but it's the direction that the P.E. is going in the comparison to what we'd call the average P.E. that matters. In long term, historically, the average P.E. has been in the 16-17 range, and I mean going back to 1927. So that goes through a lot of different up and down periods. So the long term average is about 16-17. Now, lately, it's been in that 17-18 range, and yes, now it's in the 20. We've had a wonderful, wonderful run-up. The last 8 years since the last recession and the bear market of 07-08, you know, we've had a nice run since 09 and right through to where we are now. Not a straight-up run, but a very nice long-term average run. And if you benefited from that, well, that was because you were patient and you didn't let the activity of the market back in 08 completely freak you out and make you forget that markets go through cycles. But what you may see as part of this current consolidation is sectors that have underperformed other sectors, the ones that simply didn't participate in the rally, may do a little bit better than other sectors. So we'll be watching for that. We'll be looking to see what the averages are. But a P.E. of 20, when they say, oh, this could be just like what happened back in 1999, early 2000, remember that? The market went into a bear market for 30 months. From March of 2000 all the way through October of 2002, and the market lost over a third of its value in that time. And it was painful because it wasn't a short-lived one. It was very long term. 30 months is a long, dragged out sort of market, bear market, not just a correction. But the thing is, the period that followed was very, very nice. Period 2003, 4, 5, 6, and into 7 was a great run up in the market. The market recovered nicely. Everything that it gave up in the bear market, you had to be disciplined to accommodate it. But remember something, a large part of that bear market was driven by problems. I'm talking about the one from the 90s, late 90s, 99. That was the dot-com bubble. You had people like Alan Greenspan, the Fed chairman, Federal Reserve chair at the time, talking about irrational exuberance. People were irrational. They were too excited. They didn't understand, or they were ignoring the potential risks that were out there. And the P.E. ratio of the market at that era, combining both the blue chips as well as the NASDAQ, the P.E.s were in the 40s, 50s, and even 60s. That means you were paying $60 to buy $1 of earnings. Today, what makes it different is the PEs are a third of that. So you're paying $20 to get $1 of earnings. Now, again, you don't have to understand the technical elements of that. Just understand the difference between the period we saw back in late 1999, early 2000. It is not the same. It is very, very, very different. That doesn't mean you won't see a correction on occasion. But right at this stage of the game, I'm not worried about a big meltdown in this market. We'll talk a little bit more after this. We're going to halftime here on the Money Talk program. You're listening to AM 790, your home of talk and business, and I'm Don Sowa. Glad to have you here. I'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the Money Talk program. It's the second half of the show. Now, just to show you, despite all of the recent political rhetoric, the United States is not simply some big island unto itself, cordoned off from the rest of the world by some gigantic big wall, even if the president would like to move us in that direction. But overseas markets do affect the U.S. market. European equities traded lower today after the G20. The 20 largest trading companies, that, which also make up the European Union, a great many of them, they failed to agree on some joint communication that supported free and open trade. Now, why would that happen? Well, it's probably in response to the rhetoric coming out of the White House, some of it during the campaign when Donald Trump was running for president, and, of course, some of it coming from current rhetoric now that he is president. Not getting the sense from anyone, whether it's Secretary Tillerson or any other spokespeople for the executive branch, that the United States is going to honor or be a part of any specific type of free or open trade arrangements that have already been part of the global trading environment. Of course, the president would simply describe that feeling that he believes in free trade, but he feels that the United States has been unfairly treated in a great many of the trade arrangements that you see out there. There may be isolated circumstances where that is the case, but, and of course, we on this show are not going to go into the rather complex description, at least not tonight, we don't have the time, the complex definition of why is free trade important, who does it actually help, based upon our experience with trade arrangements, whether it's NAFTA or other trade arrangements we have with European countries or the Pacific-based countries, you know, who does benefit from them and in what way? And is there a linkage between the trade arrangements that we have with some countries and other political benefits that we derive, whether it's in the area of security, global security, intelligence gathering, and a number of other areas, the ability to use the influence of trading partners in other types of political negotiations. If you are alienating these traditional allies of ours, whether it be in the economic arena or in the military arena or in the intelligence gathering arena, the end result, even to a country as powerful and wealthy as the United States, can be, detrimental at best. The pound slipped against the dollar after the Prime Minister Theresa May, who, by the way, has already visited with President Trump at the White House, when her office did in fact announce that the country will trigger Article 50, which is the technical rule and law that has to be passed by Parliament, triggering it to exit the European Union on March the 29th. That's coming up in a couple of days, folks. The country is divided on this issue. They've learned since the original Brexit vote. They've learned what Brexit will actually mean for them. Some of them feel betrayed. Some people feel that they weren't educated properly. They even blame the media, the Daily Mail. The week that the Brexit vote took place, that following weekend, there was a 5-page article in the Daily Mail on the in the Sunday version of the paper, which explained, okay, what's next for the United Kingdom and its people now that they've voted to leave the European Union? Well, a lot of people, I mean, tens of thousands of people sent in communications to the Daily Mail after that saying, why are you telling us this now? Why was this 5-page article not out 2 and 3 weeks ago in the Sunday paper explaining to us before we voted as to what the ramifications, political, the ramifications for jobs, ramifications for income, the ramifications for currency exchange? Guess what? A lot of things happen when you leave. It's like it would be like Florida leaving the United States, or Texas even leaving the United States. There are some people there who would like to, but their ramifications for Texas would clearly not be in their best interest, even though there might be some individualized local self-interests. So obviously Great Britain itself is divided on this issue, but Theresa May is going to start touring roadshow, touring the country in an attempt to bring the all the countries, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, North Ireland, and England together on this, and looking to create more support for this major change, which will be voted on by Parliament coming up very shortly. It's Article 50, they call it. And needless to say, that's creating some anxiety now that what was originally just a philosophical vote, seemingly, but now it's going to become real as they present Article 50 to Parliament. A major change for them ultimately. Now, the other thing that people have got to look to is we've been hearing an awful lot about what we call the Trump rally, right? This big rally that has taken place really since the election itself back in November and right here through to into the month of March. It's gone up quite a bit. Now, the question is, who's making all the money? I mean, is the average individual investor, is the average mom and pop investor out there actually getting left in the dust, or is there broad-based participation in this particular market? And we've looked at it a number of times. We've seen a number of different groups, and the folks over at CNBC have looked at it too. An analyst over there named Jeff Cox, and a writer for them, has put together an article explaining, you know, when it comes right down to it. Everybody's been talking about the market, the stock market, and how well it's been doing and what it all means. But the question is, what it all means for who? So the Trump rally is just the latest leg in really what has been a pretty wild, I mentioned it in the last segment, an 8-year movement higher. Not an explosion so much, but a rally, really nice rally since the beginning of 2009 after the recession. But mom and pop investors, well, I don't know how impressed they really are. By multiple measures, lots of different ways of looking at it, the retail investing crowd really hasn't been a significant player in what is now the second longest running bull market we've seen on record. Sentiment surveys show fewer than, say, 1 in 3 individuals believe that stocks will be higher 6 months from now. Now, I happen to believe that they will be. I believe that 2017 is going to be a good year for stocks overall. As high as they are already up, I believe they'll be up higher by year end. That doesn't mean that you won't see some bouncing around and some volatility. I think there will be, maybe in the third quarter even, which wouldn't shock me, but I believe fourth quarter you're going to see some strength just like last year. Households were net sellers of stocks last year in 2016 and even exited stocks during the fourth quarter to some degree when Donald Trump's upset victory over Hillary Clinton sent the market surging all of a sudden. And at least one market expert believes the trend of retail investors sitting things out is likely going to continue, at least through the rest of this year, despite having had a pretty promising start. Now, in 2017, we expect history is going to repeat itself, according to David Kostin, who's with Goldman Sachs. He's a U.S. equity strategist over there. And that's what he's telling his clients. Corporations and exchange-traded funds, which are basically indices that trade like stocks, it's a basket, they will continue to drive equity demand, while mutual funds, individual households, and perhaps pension plans, pension funds, will remain probably net sellers of stocks throughout the year. Now, households are coming off of a year in which they sold net about $39 billion in stocks or stock equities during a year that saw the S&P 500 rise nearly 10%. Now, that's 12% including dividends reinvested. So that means that these people, individual investors, households, were net selling $39 billion of stocks. That means some, yes, some people were buying, but more people were selling than those that were buying, and the net was minus $39 billion. They missed out, and this is the weird part of this. They did that in a year where the S&P 500, the top 500 biggest companies in the U.S., went up double digits, 12% when you include their dividends. Even without the dividends, they were up 10%. That's according to some data from the Federal Reserve compiled by Goldman Sachs. Mutual funds, which Morningstar estimates to be 65% owned by retail investors, which is usually households, they dumped a net $117 billion during the course of a year, again, when the S&P was going up over 10%. That included $46 billion in the fourth quarter alone, when the S&P gained almost 4%. It was up about 3.5%. So in a year where the general direction of the stock market was higher, these individuals were selling, for the most part, not all, but more people were selling than those that were buying. Foreign investors also were selling stocks, by the way. They dropped about $60 billion worth after their elections over there. Now, again, analyst Kostin, he expects the tide actually to continue at this pace. He thinks there'll still be, even though there will be buyers, there will be people buying and hopefully making money, but there are probably more people selling than those that are buying. Mutual fund forecasts to sell maybe a net $50 billion this year. Now, granted, it is a huge, huge market. These may be small numbers compared to the overall size of the investment markets, even the retail market, but it's still reasonably large numbers, folks. And it shows you what side of the decision the average retail household investor is. Maybe it also shows you why they are not participating the way they should be in a market that seemingly gives them every opportunity to accumulate wealth, but they're not. We'll talk a little bit more about that when I come back from this brief break. This is Money Talk, folks. I'm Don Soa. I'm a certified financial planner professional, an investment advisor, and your best friend here on a ride home Monday through Friday here on the Money Talk program. Call us at 437-5000. That's the local number, or 888-345-0790. Brett's here. He's taking your calls. I shall return. And we're back with the Money Talk program. I'm Don Soa. We've been talking a little bit about the issue of whether or not the retail household investor is participating in what has been a pretty impressive rally, not just this year, but going back 8 years to the end of the recession back in 08, early 09. Now, bearish sentiment, it's pretty hard to find in the current rally, but the most recent survey from the American Association of Individual Investors puts the bulls, people who are bullish, at right around 31.2%. And that's below the long-term average of bulls, which is 38.5. Now, bearishness came down from about 46.5 the week before to about 38.7%. But that remains, you know, above the average anyway. There's a lot of concern that stocks maybe run too far too fast. Maybe they just need a break. Contrast that with Investors Intelligence Survey of market professionals. That just 2 weeks ago had pretty much had hit bullishness at a 30-year high, and the disparity becomes even clearer. It may actually be just that the institutional crowd, the professionals, the institutional corporate investors, they simply have more of a stomach for all of the political volatility that's happening around us in Washington. Those two different behaviors are really detached, because an institutional investor is looking specifically at how is the overall economy going to do in this political environment. And an individual is looking at their own personal comfort level. How do these events affect me and my family individually, personally? That may be where the difference is. Michael Kresh, who's a managing member of a creative wealth management group down in New York, he said this isn't a fear of the market. This is a fear of what's going on in Washington, and how is that going to come out. Now, Kresh himself said that his client's political stance clearly tends to lean to the left, so they've got to be more liberal. And they worry that Donald Trump's seemingly daily controversies are going to eat into their investments and their retirement plans. They don't have a great deal of faith, in other words. And that's probably just a carryover from the campaigns. Now, what's happening here is there's a strong issue with the news out of Washington, although the institutional investors believe that the administration is going to be very beneficial for the markets and the economy. They're cutting back on regulations. They're trying to pump money into the system. They're trying to reduce tax liability for both corporations and individuals. Individuals are coming, you know, unfortunately, that's groupthink, who are looking at the big picture for the overall economy, where individual or households are becoming more uncomfortable with a lot of the infighting and a lot of the negativity that you hear every day in the news. Now, the good news for those who have sort of stuck it out in the market is that there should be plenty of that institutional cash that's out there that has been driving the market. There's plenty of that cash around to continue to push stock market prices higher over the next year and perhaps longer. Goldman Sachs forecasts that corporations will be buying about $700 billion worth of their own shares this year. Net equity purchases from corporations and exchange-traded funds in 2016 totaled about $584 billion and about $188 billion respectively. Now, that the retail crowd still isn't ready to dive into this market carries a silver lining with it, though. Usually, strong retail participation signals a bear market has pretty much expended nearly all of its energy. That means that the downside is that it also points to the disturbing historical trend that individual investors tend to buy high and sell low. There's a love-hate relationship when that happens. Professionals know that's the beginning of the end, according to folks over at Client First Strategies, which is a boutique outfit up in New York. If you're into risk management, this is not a happy time for you. Now, based on what they're gleaning from their own client discussions, these folks predict that the sentiment survey are going to probably turn somewhat soon. I see the interest in equities rising right now, according to these analysts, Grist as well as Goldberg, and it doesn't necessarily mean the bear market is right around the corner. It could take a while, but before the bull market ends, you have to see some sort of a general move of the retail or household investor actually moving into the market. They tend to jump in at the very end of what has been a bull market cycle. They tend to jump in right near the end, and that's a lot of cash flooding into the market chasing equities typically. So the move away from equities that we saw in the past by institutional investors, there's a contrarian indicator taking place here. Now, that doesn't mean that there will not be some sort of a contraction. It doesn't mean that there will not be, eventually, a correction in the market. We may see what we've seen over the last few years, where there have been multiple events where there were what we call pullbacks. A pullback is not a correction. A correction is a 10% decline from the high. A bear market is a 20% correction from the high. Now, what you call a bear market trend would be a 20% decline which occurred over a dragged out period of time. Corrections that we've seen lately or pullbacks over the last 8 years have been very short-lived, and in some cases that have been 3-5% moves to the downside. We've even seen some years where it happened 2 or 3 times. So it didn't qualify either as a bear market or as a major correction. It was just a series of market adjustments, but at the end of the year, the invested individual or group ended up not only higher, but maybe considerably higher, high single-digit, even low double-digit returns. You should invest your money in a way that's consistent with the goals that you have personally. If you're a long-term investor and your money will be invested for 10 or 15 or 20 years before you need to actually start using it, and that'll be different from person to person, but if you've got some time, then you've got the ability to ride out or travel through some of those ups and downs and those market pullbacks or even a correction, as we've seen in the past. In 2001 and 2, the market lost a third of its value. But from 2003 through 2007, it more than doubled during that time frame and more than made up for the value that was lost. In 2007 and most of it in 2008, we saw the market lose a sizable amount in a very, very short period of time. And I'm sure there were some investors, if you were 100% invested in stocks, you might have seen as much as 40% or more of the value of your account go down. Although I seriously doubt that most people listening to the show were 100% invested in stocks. So the more likely scenario is you saw movements of, say, minus 20 to minus 30 in those types of stock-heavy portfolios. But in 2009 through 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, right through 8 years later, the market has gone up dramatically during that time frame. You would have earned back, if you stayed invested or if you invested properly, you would have returned all of the money that you may have lost in 08 and found yourself with a sizable mid- to high single-digit return on average, including 08, for the last 10 years. Again, it's all about attitude, it's all about behavior, and that's what we're talking about now, trying to figure out what kind of behavior institutional investors will have, what kind of individual investors will the individual household investor have. We hope you're part of the group that makes money in the environment we're in right now. I'm Don Soa. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in tomorrow. Donna Grace will be here with myself for Get Back to Basics Money Talk right here on AM 790. Have a good night.